My sister and I, we look very similar. And so she was quite good friends with my sister. That was my opportunity to meet Liz. And she is just the sweetest person. And I'm very pleased that our paths crossed. And she is basically like one of the siblings in our family, very close with our family. And I know we all enjoy having her be a part of that. So I guess that's not a really universal intro, but I'm glad that you all hopefully either know Liz already and enjoyed that or have this new opportunity to meet her. So and her talks are always so good. It's whenever I hear Liz is going to be one of our presenters, I'm very excited. So
thanks, Heather. That was a really lovely introduction. When you said, I don't know if there's anything you want me to tell them, my instant thought was, well, there are a number of things I don't want you to tell them because our families do go way back together. Nothing serious, though. So I'm going to open with a meme. For anyone who can't see the visuals, although it looks to me like they're coming out really well, Joanne, way to go. I'm asking Joanne to do new technology this time, so we'll see how it goes. It says, women's magazines really convinced me that going from day to night was going to be a big part of my adult life, but so far it has not come up. And I laughed when I read this because I remembered being little tiny Liz, and there was this article in some magazine that was, I don't know, doctor's office or whatever, and I'd always look at the women's magazines because I wanted to know what was coming, right? And it was an article about handbags that go from day to night. And I remember feeling very excited because I thought, ooh, night handbags. Like, are they glow in the dark? Do they have flashlights built in? What do you put in a night handbag like a superhero? And I remember thinking, I don't understand the difference here. And having this ominous feeling of I was going to need to understand it and nobody was explaining it to me. And what was I going to do when I became an adult and I needed to go from day to night? Because clearly there was more to it than the going from day to night that I'd been experiencing. So I remember that feeling as a young girl, that I was going to grow up to be this mysterious creature that knew these other things. This woman would have kids. She would research which music classes would be best for them. She'd drive them there in the carefully selected minivan. She would have no trouble going from day to night and understanding what that was. She would vote. She would recycle. She would buy ethically sourced clothing and local food. She would have color-coded bins in the front hall for the papers that they brought home from school. I didn't just get this from women's magazines either, by the way, who did have a financial interest in convincing me of all the things I would need and the stuff I'd need to do those things. My elaborate images of adult life also were about things that had nothing to do with buying stuff. It was also about activities and about knowledge. It was very much about knowledge, actually. In school, I was led to believe that life would hold a practical application for all kinds of knowledge, from balancing chemical equations to the timeline of the French Revolution. Neither of these things has come up yet either. Although I do understand the idea that those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And Louis XVI has made some pretty big mistakes. I do understand that did come back to bite him during the French Revolution. It's just that I have not myself had the opportunity to repeat the mistakes of Louis XVI because I don't set the tax agenda. I realized I could have a little bit more sway on the tax agenda if I were a better activist, which I did imagine I would be. It is on my list of things with the carefully selected music lessons and the color-coded bins in the front hallway. And I do intend to do my part in reforming our tax structures to be more equitable. I just haven't quite gotten to that yet. Oh, the things that I imagined I would do. That is one of the biggest lies of school, the myth of the well-rounded creature and how important well-roundedness actually is. In school, if your English grade is an F, nobody cares about your A+ in math. You have to go to special education classes for that English grade. Nobody suggests special education for your A+ in math. Nobody says there's clearly a talent here or a passion or both, and we should put a little bit of extra effort in here to really let this blossom. And it's a little strange that we don't do that if you think about it, because the real world works just the oppositely. It's the A+ grades that matter in the real world. If your accountant is a great accountant, you don't ask her if her front entryway is tidy, and you couldn't care less if her handbag goes from day to night. Anyways, real life cares about the A+ grades way more than the D-minuses. Real life is mostly about being able to put the effort in to have a couple of areas of achievement where you can do things really well and to use those areas well. And it's about letting the rest of that stuff go, which is not what they taught us in school. In school, they taught us about this. And Joanne's going to put another poster up. This was a poster up actually that was in my classroom. I remember staring at this poster as a child when I was not paying attention to the French Revolution. And for anyone who can't see it, it's a poster. It says, "Never give up." And someone said as we were getting ready, and it's a poster of a bird having a meal, which I guess is the case from the bird's perspective. From the meal's perspective, he's holding a chokehold on the bird so that the bird can't swallow him. And it's funny, and I guess it's sort of true. I mean, in this particular case, the lesson does apply. Sometimes the stakes are so big that the odds don't matter, and you want to give your full effort. But never give up? That is terrible, terrible advice. Knowing when to quit is critical, because that's where you get the energy and the time and the resources to invest in the places where it really will matter. Grit and perseverance are important, but not if they're randomly poured into everything. They must be applied strategically in the important places. So never underestimate the power of quitting. I prefer this next motivational poster, which I'll get Joanne to try putting up. It's a picture of Mount Everest, and it says, "Motivation. Every corpse on Mount Everest was once a highly motivated person." And I'm not kidding when I say I find this idea inspirational. To me, it embodies a kind of complex image of persistence. Proceed wisely, it cautions. Know when to hold them and when to fold them, as the song goes, know when to walk away, and know when to run. In the real world, quitting is an indispensable part of success. To achieve any big goal, creating a business, getting a degree, creating an amazing piece of art, you need persistence. To choose one thing and give it the effort you need to give it means walking away from many other choices. So if you're going to achieve a big thing or even a medium thing, a huge part of that success is quitting. Quit often and quit early, I like to say. This is also true of congregations, especially smaller congregations where it's so easy to get sucked into this idea that you need every program and every committee and every worship element, and you need all of these things to a standard of perfection like in bigger congregations. There's so much information out there about how to do things that starts with the assumption of paid staff and swaths of volunteers and a huge budget, and small congregations are never going to do things that way. When you're a small congregation, you need to know what your lifeblood is, and you need to quit the rest of it. You need to know which programs are not for you, and you need to know which people aren't for you. Quitting some people too is valuable. There's this idea that we want our congregations to welcome everybody, that every time a visitor comes in and then leaves, it's a failure. Except if we really are picking the few things that we love and doing those things well, a lot of people will come and leave. Doing something well means committing to a certain set of priorities, forming a certain culture, getting behind goals, and diving deep into that means you're not going to be the right cup of tea for someone else for whom other things are a priority. Being deeply valuable to one small group means spreading yourself too thin trying to be everything to everyone. So both personally and as organizations, we should be doing a fair bit of quitting. But not only quitting, there's also a place for persistence through what's hard. So the million-dollar question is, how does one quit strategically? How do you tell if a relationship is the embodiment of relationships take work, or if it's a relationship that you need to walk away from? How do you tell if a project is just hitting the snags that projects hit and you need to persevere, or if it's not something that's going to work? How do you tell if you're just struggling to practice guitar because nobody loves practicing, or if this is not an instrument for you? You've got to know when to hold him and know when to fold him, says the song. But I notice the song does not get into a lot of specifics about how you should know when to hold them and when to fold them. Author Seth Godin addresses this question in his book, The Dip. In that book, he outlines three graphs. The graphs are a visual representation of how much effort brings you how much payoff as you persist with whatever it is you're working on through time. So looking at the cliff for a moment, that curve starts off very high and then it drops off. So that's an image of an addictive pattern. So I think here about smoking. I don't know a ton about smoking, but I did inhale from a cigarette during that critical 15 years old period that Heather told you about. And I remember inhaling and thinking, it must take so much discipline to do this for long enough to look cool doing it. As I understand it, smoking, if you can actually do a full inhalation, does give you a buzz, like a happy little feeling. It's a little hard, but you get a good reward. But as you become more addicted, of course, the reward tapers off. Eventually, you're addicted to a thing that you have to put all kinds of effort into, buying cigarettes, ducking out for breaks, arguing with some family members, trying to stop. And the results and the payoff are much less. Cigarettes don't make you nearly as happy 5 years in as they did in the beginning. So the effort to reward line drops off. Godin calls this the cliff pattern. Not every cliff is an addiction. Anything you do that brings you reward in the short term, but has a future where you'll still be putting in effort, but not getting rewards is a cliff pattern. And you don't want to invest in a cliff. You want to get out of that as soon as you can. The next one, the dotted line, Seth Godin and I disagree a little bit about the dotted line. He calls this one a cul-de-sac, and it looks like a flat line. You're putting in pretty constant effort for pretty constant rewards. So Godin's best example of this is a dead-end job with no room for advancement. He also thinks that this graph indicates that you should quit as early as possible, just like with the cliff. I don't totally agree with this. I think there are a lot of cul-de-sacs in life that I'm very happy with. Thank you. Physical activity, for example. I'm a pretty bad athlete. I've picked sports to do that I am never going to get good at. I do not progress in these sports. I exercise, I put in effort, and then I get some joy, some benefits to my sleep and my mood and my focus, but I don't get any progressing. Everything just stays the same. Next year, my efforts will probably be about the same. My rewards will be about the same, and I'm fine with that. So I think a cul-de-sac is okay if it's something that you love or gives you enough reward in the moment. Although I do think it's helpful to know it's a cul-de-sac because it takes some of the pressure off. And I find it leaves me a little bit more room to own my enjoyment of whatever the thing is. And it reminds me to reevaluate periodically to make sure that the rewards are still worth the effort. The big one, though, is the dip. The dip looks like this. In the beginning, when you're first, say, learning the guitar, the gains come fast and easy. You couldn't do anything 3 weeks ago. Now you can play several songs. It's highly rewarding for not too much effort. But by 6 months in, you've picked all the low-hanging fruit. You're still working hard, but the level of progress is much less. The rewards are less. You're pretty good at guitar, but a lot of people are pretty good at guitar. So if you're hoping your guitar skill will be something you can use out in the world, you're going to need to spend a lot of time pushing through this low-reward, high-effort time to get to the spot where your skills can really shine. Of course, you can go with the cul-de-sac plan, and I think that's a fabulous idea for something you love. I am a cul-de-sac guitarist myself. But if you want to do something big, you're going to need to excel. And that means pushing through the dip, which most people never do, and getting it to the other side of it where few people are, where you have a very valuable skill. Now, Godin mostly talks about this from the perspective of a career, and I think it is most easily applicable there. Going from no skills to few skills, say as a web designer, is not a huge amount of effort, but it's a good payoff. You can get some lower wage contracts helping out with simple projects, and there's lots of those in the world. But if you want a career that really pays dividends, that's really exceptional, you're going to need to push through that dip and become an exceptional web designer. And because so few people do this, the rewards of having done it are very high. But this is also true of non-career things. Relationships are fun in the beginning and rewarding, also at the middle and longer parts where you have years together under your belt and you have deep intimacy. But there is a definite dip challenge part in relationships where the new glow has worn off and you're working things out, but you haven't really gotten to the long-lasting intimacy yet. There's also a dip in health. So making a dietary change, for example, is exciting and very rewarding in the beginning, and you're reading the books and you're very excited, and then there's this dip. It gets boring and hard, and the gains aren't coming nearly so quickly. In the distant future, if you stick with it, it becomes much easier. Your habits become automatic. Your sense of identity shifts to someone who, say, doesn't eat sugar anymore. After a couple years, you forget what dessert tastes like, and it's hardly hard at all, even as the health gains continue to build from your investment. My favorite personal example of a dip from my life has been learning to keep my house tidy. At first, I had all the determination and the energy, and I saw great improvement, which was motivating. And then there came several months of really pushing hard to put things away when I was done with them, which was boring and annoying. But I did stick with it. And then there's this magical phase where if something is out of place, my hand reaches out and grabs it and puts it where it belongs without even noticing that I'm doing it. This is called automaticity. You've probably achieved it with the act of putting on your seatbelt, and it is a huge payoff. So the strategy that Godin recommends is to try to figure out as quickly as possible if you're going to quit or not. You try things out, you gather information about how they fit, and then you assess. And to do this, he suggests that you consider the long-term curve of whatever it is you're working on. Will the payoff taper off? Will it stay the same? Will it go through a dip and then skyrocket? And this is important to think about because quitting because things are terribly uncomfortable is a really bad reason to quit. conversely, failing to quit something you should quit because the quitting itself will be hard, also not a great idea. So discomfort is often not the best indicator. It can, for example, indicate that you're in a dip curve as well. And some of the best things that you want to persevere through involve a dip curve. So zooming out and thinking about the curves that go in outlines helps you think a little bit more strategically, which is crucial because strategic thinking and frequent quitting is what gives you the energy for the follow through on the few things that you've chosen as rewarding. So giving yourself permission to choose one or two causes you'll put energy into as an activist helps you move from a kind of shallow, it's important to be informed scrolling phase and step into concrete action on a few causes in a sustained and effective way, if activism is the thing that you happen to be looking at. But it applies to all kinds of different areas. To succeed at a few things, you must develop a healthy practice of quitting. It's a key skill. So I'm going to encourage you now to think of some of the things in your life that are worth letting go of. I'm not talking necessarily about addictions or seriously entrenched habits you need to break. That is a different topic and would be awesome to dive into on a different day. But for right now, I want you to think about some of the things in your life that you have to kind of keep pushing yourself to do or you feel you should be doing, obligations, things that you feel a little bit guilty about, or maybe something that you're just doing because it's a part of the image you have of yourself. Think of a place or some places where you think you're this sort of person and you've never really challenged whether the investment you're making is a wise one. What could you let go of? We're going to skip a little bit ahead in the order of service, but don't worry, we're going to come back to the offering. But first, I'm going to play a slideshow of just some photos that people sent in last month in the Hysterical Society of favorite water places. They're just nice meditative images to look at. And while we look at them, we're going to play a song by Ali Halpert called Loosen, Loosen, that I really love. And as it plays, I invite you to sit with the question of what you might let go. You can sing along if you like, or you can just think. And if you want to, I invite you, as you think of things you might want to let go, to type them into the chat if you want us to know what you're letting go of so we can hold that in community and support you in it. But however you choose to do it, I invite you to relax into thinking about what you might release so as to free yourself to dive into what matters most to you.
Loosen, loosen, baby, you don't have to carry the weight of the world in your muscles and bones. Let go, let go, let go. Loosen, loosen, baby, you don't have to carry the weight of the world in your muscles and bones. Let go, let go, let go. Holy breath and holy name. Will you ease, will you ease this pain? Holy breath and holy name. Will you ease, will you ease this pain? Loosen, loosen, baby, and you don't have to carry the weight of the world in your muscles and bones. You ease, let go, let go, let go. Loosen, loosen, baby, and you don't have to carry the weight of the world in your muscles and bones. You ease, go, let go. Pain. The weight of the world in your muscles and muscles and bones let go. The weight of the world in your muscles and bones.